my God, everything worked. What do you think about that, boys?
There you go.
Yeah, you know, party night here. But party night at the Mead House here tonight. Everything is working after three. Well, I won't use those terms, but three shows that kind of went south. And we are pretty good to go here tonight. So actually had to uninstall and reinstall all the freaking software and everything. But I think we got that problem solved. It turned out to be some kind of a little virus, Trojan little. Anyhow, who does that kind of stuff, you know? I mean, if I could get my hands around their neck, you know?
Somebody with a lot of time on their hands, yeah.
So, but hey, welcome to the Mead House. This is a show for home mead makers who really want to make good mead at home. Let us throw the honey out for you, as Mississippi Chris would tell you. And, you know, we do plenty of experimenting at home, and we kind of know what works, what doesn't work, and what's out there. And we're just having a good time at it. None of us are experts. We're all kind of learning the process. And hey, you know, guys, I think the fun thing about mead is it's such a young industry. And I think Chris has mentioned it on other shows where the home mead maker is really on the forefront of the whole industry. We're kind of setting the pace, I think. You know, because it all starts here at home. You know, before you branch out and open up your meadery, I mean, you know, obviously, first thing off, you got to make good mead at home, right?
Sure.
It all starts there.
Aaron Martin joins us tonight. And, of course, you just heard him, Mississippi Chris Spencer, Jeff Schaus in the house. And, of course, J.D. Webb, that's me. A couple of shout-outs here. First thing first, Jason Bott caught up with him in the Mead Makers Facebook group. He's got a batch of mixed berry and clover using a 71B yeast. He was making he remarked about the cap that had developed in his, you know, obviously he's not using a fruit bag, but want to make sure that, you know, you push that cap down, Jason, and keep that thing submerged as often as you can. Don't let that thing sit for a day or, you know, more than a day with that yeast churning, especially that 71B churning away underneath it. And you might want to go to Home Depot, pick up a paint strainer bag, nylon paint strainer bag. That's what I use. They come in different sizes. And put your fruit in that. And at the same time, you still have to keep it kind of punched down and submerged and, you know, keep it mixed up. But, hey, good luck with that batch of mixed berry mead you got going out there. Another shout-out to Dan Crosscarry. He's been listening to our show. And Chris, this is pretty much for you. He caught up with us because he heard you talking about your curry mead. But he did write in and he says, hey, just want to give you kudos to the show. Love that you guys get right to the meat of the discussion. No filters, no commercials or jingles or nonsense. Great discussion. It's what it is what it's all about. And, but Chris, we kind of want to remind Dan that we did do some editing to that curry mead, right?
We did. And it's nothing too major, but right at the end, if you've already looked at it, Dan, originally we had said that to top up, when you go into tertiary, top it up with some water. And we've changed that because I started looking at it and thinking about it, and there's going to be quite a bit of volume lost coming off the coconut right at the end. So you're going to have a significant amount of headspace to try and make up there. And we've given you two options. Number one is to top up with a white wine. And personally, I think JD may have listed like a Pinot or something. Personally, I would probably go with something a little sweeter. If you could find a sweet Riesling or maybe a sweet Gewurztraminer or something, seeing as how it is a sweeter mead, but you can top up with that. Or my preference is I have a ginger mead sitting around, and that's what I would top up with. I think the ginger will go perfect with the curry.
Sounds like that'll work. Jeff, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. I just has a little, my Skype has a little deal on there. It says, you're unable to join this call. So I guess you're not here. I know Scott Monroe's probably listening too. Scott's out there in Corinth, Mississippi, one of Chris's neighbors. I know, Chris, did you ever manage to hook up with Scott at all, or email him, or?
I haven't yet. I think I emailed him. We haven't hooked up yet, but what's coming in the future, we're gonna get around to that.
Very good. You know, we've got a pair of apps now. You can go right to our show, listen live. You can get it right there at our website, themeathouse.com. There's an app for iOS and an app for Android. So if you've got a smartphone or device of either variety, download the meathouse.com app and it'll take you right to our show. Bypass all the other radio station stuff and all that. So it's a pretty cool deal. So every Tuesday night here at 9 o'clock, just, you know, go to that app and you're there. I hope you're listening live. Either way, themeathouse.com is our website. We even have a Facebook. Figured we better throw at least one social media up. I do not tweet. Okay. I am not getting into Twitter. Tweeter. I have a tweeter, but I'm not tweeting.
Okay? I was going to say, JD, I've been known to see a tweet or two come off of your account.
It's,
but
it's automatic. You know, when I put a post up on the website, it goes out to Twitter and to the Facebook thing, and that's about the extent of it. So,
gotcha.
You know, I figured, you know, if anybody's out there following the Twitter thing, then hey, you know what? Might as well tell them about the show too. So,
there you go.
If you are listening live, you can call us anytime during the show. 818-921-4680. We're still waiting on that first phone call, but hey, what the heck? You know, we're still having a good time with you or without you. What are you guys drinking? Aaron, what do you got in the glass?
Well, JD, I don't know if I'm going to be able to pronounce this thing. It's a South African mead out of the Makana Meadery in Grahamstown, South Africa. And here goes nothing. The name of this mead is Icky Licky Chili Zombamvu. It is a mead, a pretty sweet mead, aged with chilies and French oak. So kind of a lot of different flavors going on here. A little bit of spicy, a little bit of sweet, and even a little bit of tartness going on. So say that 10 times fast.
I was going to say, shall we punish Aaron some more? Say it again, Aaron.
We'll give it a go. It probably won't sound anything like the first go around, but we'll give it another go. Icky Laka Chili Zombamvu.
All right. I'm going to get the recording of the show, and I'm going to cut that little piece out, and I'm just going to play it, you know. As a
spectrum, so. Yeah, can we make like a remix of that?
Yeah.
I like it.
Jeff, what's going on in your house? What do you got in the glass tonight?
Tonight I'm drinking one of my favorite experiments from last summer. Actually, it's used SO4, the ale yeast, and a little bit of French oak just to make a traditional. It's kind of it's off dry. Got some of that nice nice oaky feel to it, and it's really pleasant.
You like that O4 in a traditional? It seemed to work pretty good.
Yeah, it's actually, following this experiment, I tried it in a couple other different meads, and it's really quickly becoming a standard around here.
Yeah, cool, good. I've used it in a cider or two, here and have been pleased with the outcome. And I'll have to try it in a mead.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to try it in the cider, actually.
Chris, I know you're probably still off the alcohol here for a little while due to the meds and stuff, but have you been able to at least sneak a sip here and there?
Not really, but I've got a wonderful here in the shaker. I've got an Optimum Nutrition double chocolate protein shake. It's made with whole milk, and it's a heavy body drink. It's got some essential amino acids, branched chain amino acids. It's on the sweet side. It goes down well.
If that wasn't a plug for Ensure, I don't know what was. Poor Chris, man. I sympathize with you, bud. Been there.
This is better than Ensure.
Yeah. You know, they gave me that stuff when I was in the hospital because I the hospital food just sucked. And I was not hungry at all. I just had no appetite. And they said, you got to eat. And then finally, they said, you either drink this Ensure or we're going to put the tube down your nose. So I was drinking Ensure left and right just so I wouldn't get that tube stuck down my nose. But
Well, I also have a glass of Lipton iced tea on the side, too, if I want to. So I've got two choices here.
Is that the chaser?
Yeah. Now chase it with some iced tea.
There you go. Well, I cracked open a bottle of what I call January White again. I think I might have drank this on the first show, but this is my first big batch mead that I made last January, 2014, actually. Or 2015, pardon me. So it's a little over a year old. It's starting to come around. It's starting to taste more and more like a white wine now. Very, very, very slight bit of sweetness to it. It's, I don't know, what do you call it, an off-dry, I guess. It was made with orange blossom honey and D47, and it was kind of a takeoff on the Joe's Ancient Orange thing, but I decided I better use some real yeast for this little project, and it was really hot when I finished. Of course, you know, I didn't know anything about temperatures back then, but it's really starting to smooth out now, and I'm really enjoying this. So the show tonight, we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about the science of things, just a little bit of time, plus we got some other things to talk about. I know Jeff got some feedback from the Mazer Cup from his entry. I know he wants to talk about that a little bit. And Aaron, you got some experiments going on that we still need to catch up on and find out what's going on there. But let's start with Chris. Oxidative and reductive fermentations. Chris, what's that all about?
Well, it's a very simple thing to do, but it can be a little bit complicated to decide when and where to do it. Basically, let's just start from the beginning. And you said the scientific side of things. I'm going to try to avoid as much science as possible here because it's been 20-something years since organic chemistry for me. And I don't think anyone really cares. but basically an oxidative ferment is going to occur in the presence of oxygen, and a reductive ferment is going to occur in the absence of it. And they both have pros and cons, and both can be taken to extremes. I don't know if the home mead maker, you know, we always think about things that affect our mead. We think about the kind of honey we use. We think about the kind of yeast. We think about the ingredients, the pH, the temperature, you know, all these things. But I don't think anybody ever takes into account the fact of putting a lid on their fermentation bucket as affecting the outcome. But it certainly does. So
As far as putting this into practice, it's as simple as choosing to cover your fermentation bucket with a cloth or to put a sealable lid on and airlock it. So that's the difference in an oxidative and reductive ferment as far as carrying out the procedure. What you will find, though, is that with an oxidative ferment, you're going to get more you're starting to go toward what you would consider oxidated flavors, but you're not getting quite there yet. So one of the things that an oxidative ferment can do is it can increase body and mouth feel because it affects tannins more. I think an oxidative ferment helps to fix the some of the fine grain tannins and things in the mead. So you can sometimes increase body and mouth feel in something that's sort of lacking in a good tannin structure. But at the same time, if you go too far with it, you can start to get oxidation flavors, which would be something like cardboard, burnt chocolate, which may not always be a bad thing. So reductive, yeah, you can get sort of a burnt chocolate, kind of a wet, stale cardboard. There's a lot of flavors, just sort of a sherry type flavor.
Yeah.
You know, these oxidized flavors and aromas. It usually doesn't go to that extreme if it only occurs during the fermentation. Which is, you know, it kind of brings up another point that people need to realize. There is a significant difference between the flavor of an oxidative reduction and an oxidized mead. So oxidative flavors are very different than oxidation. And so we're dealing with active fermentation here. So if you cover your fermenter with a cloth, you're allowing oxygen, you're allowing access to oxygen, and that creates more of an oxidative fermentation. If you put a lid on your bucket and you airlock it as soon as you pitch the yeast, you're going to get more of a reductive ferment. You're restricting oxygen to that mead. And what you'll find in that direction is that you're going to usually preserve fruit flavor and aroma better. Oftentimes you'll help to bring fruit flavor, floral flavors from honey and aromas to the forefront in a mead that normally, say if you were making maybe a peach or strawberry, a reductive ferment is going to help to bring those flavors forward a little bit more. But at the same time, if you take it to extreme, you can start getting those reductive flavors that are typically associated with that, which would be something like a rotten cabbage, sort of a Band-Aid type flavors and aromas. So both of these things can go to extremes and ruin your mead.
Now, you know, when you're talking about the oxidative and, you know, slapping the lid on, putting the airlock on, and, you know, not allowing, you know.
That's reductive.
Yeah. I mean, there's probably going to be some listeners out there that are going to say, but wait a minute. You know, I thought oxygen was good for the yeast, right? And it is.
Yep, and that's the next point. Most people, whether it be professional winemakers, professional mead makers, or homebrewers, most people will never really conduct a pure 100% oxidative or a 100% reductive ferment. We're certainly not going to be doing 100% reductive ferment because we aerate and degas. So what we do is sort of a mix between things. So let me give you some examples of when I would use these. You know, like I said, doing the process is nothing. I mean, you can train a monkey to either put a cloth or a lid on. So,
yeah.
But the art comes in and knowing when to do each one. So, typically, what I would do is if I'm doing something with fruit, anything with fruit, whether it's a sizer, melomel, or anything with fruit, it gets a lid and an airlock as soon as I pitch the yeast. If I'm doing a traditional, and in some cases, metheglins, that usually gets a cloth for the first 7 days, which is sort of, you're getting some benefit of an oxidative fermentation, and then after day 7, it gets a lid and an airlock. So you get some benefits from the reductive ferment.
I'm probably putting the sock before the boot here, but I mean, how does that translate to the end result? What's the big difference in the end result?
Okay, well, one of the problems that I have always encountered with a traditional mead, just honey and water and yeast and nutrients, is that, you're lacking in that tannin. They want to turn out to be very light-bodied.
Yeah.
Sometimes the mouthfeel is not quite where you would like for it to be.
Yeah.
And that first part of that fermentation that's sort of toward the oxidative side, that's going to help fix that tannin structure that's there, if there is any.
Yeah.
And that's going to help increase your mouthfeel and the overall body of the mead. And once you get to about day 7 or so, you put a lid on it and airlock it, and then you finish it out that way, and that's sort of the reductive phase where you're bringing out the floral characters that are in that honey. So it's kind of a mix on the traditionals that I do. What I was going to say, though, I need to put this out there because somebody's going to be listening that's an expert in fermentation, experienced mead maker, experienced wine maker, or whatever. I'm making no attempt to try and stick to a textbook definition of oxidative or reductive ferments. I'm simply relaying to you my interpretation of them and my experience with them. So if you're looking for textbook definitions, this may not be it, and everyone may not agree with it, but this is my results from doing these two different techniques.
Oh, and that's kind of the whole point of this show. What works for us works for us. It might work for you. Mm-hmm. If you want to do the textbook route, then sign up at UC Davis, go through all the, get involved, get the education and whatnot, and do it that way if that's what you want to do.
Yeah, and the instructors there, if they heard me say what I just said, they might agree 100%, or they might say that's bull crap. That's not true. That's not right. Either way, it's what I refer to as an oxidative or reductive ferment, and it's the results I get. So, but that's with the traditionals and some metheglins, I'll do sort of a half and half. Now, with my melomels, it's more toward the reductive side. Anything that has fruit gets a lid and an airlock as soon as I pitch the yeast. However, we're still not really conducting a true 100% reductive ferment because we're aerating and degassing twice a day for the first 7 days. So every time we aerate and degas, we're breaking that reductive cycle. But it's still more of a reductive ferment than we would do if we had a cloth over it for the first 7 days. And this can be very useful, like I said, if you've got fruit in there, if you've got a honey that has a lot of nice floral notes that you really want to bring out, a reductive ferment will help to do that. So yeah. You're going to have to experiment. I can talk all day about what I've done. The best way for you to see it is experience it. Make you up two-gallon batches side by side. Cover one with a cloth for the first 7 days. Cover, airlock the other one through the whole ferment. Taste the difference when they're finished. You'll clearly see the difference.
Sounds like a good experiment that I might do when I get back from North Carolina. Jeff's been...
Yeah, it's just one of those things that people just don't really give a second thought to, I don't think, but it makes a big difference.
Jeff and Aaron, what are you guys' thoughts on this? I mean, do you follow the same practice Chris does with the traditional and mellow with the air locking and the towel?
No, to be honest, I've been airlocking everything I've brewed since the get-go, and I've never thought to do any different.
Yeah, I mean, same for me. Yep, mine's been more of the hybrid approach, where it, based on Chris's description, it sounds more on the reductive side because it is under an airlock, but then the periodic degassing and aeration kind of breaks that reductive cycle.
Well, I know for me, I always put a lid on it, and only because, and Chris knows from earlier shows that I did over at God Meat, and I have since calmed down quite a bit. But my kitchen area where I put my recipes together and everything was, I mean, you could do open heart surgery. I mean, I sanitize everything, the countertops, the stove, I mean, everything. I just did not want the risk of something getting into my meat. So, but I have since calmed down after, talking to people and, even Chris has told me a few things, but. That was my fear. That's why I put, a lid on everything, was just for that reason. So I may give the traditional a try, and just use the towel method for the first 7 days and see what happens.
JD, it's not without risk. When you're doing any sort of open fermentation, of course, you are open to the possibility of getting some acetobacter in there, or a tiny fruit fly comes along and finds a way in, and so it's not without risk. And you will, if you do enough of them, eventually you will have one go bad sooner or later. But normally that doesn't happen. If you use a sanitized cloth, you can steam it, you can boil it, you can dip it in your sanitizer or whatever you want to do. Secure it, string a few rubber bands together and secure it good around the bucket. And generally you'll be okay.
Yeah.
So, it is. It's not without risk. You will have one go bad on you occasionally.
Well, like I said, I've pretty much calmed down since starting this whole thing. I mean, everything I read was just sanitize, 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 and it was in my house it was put on the white lab coat, put on the smock, the operating smock with the head thing on,
Well, 20 some odd years ago, I could probably give you a really good description of all the cross-linking and everything that's going on in the chemical process throughout, you know, and give you technical data on oxidative and reductive ferments. But that was 20 some odd years ago. And, like I said, I don't really think people are that concerned with it now. I think that they just tell me what to do to make good mead. Well, it can be that simple, but then maybe it's not. You really need to experience it for yourself. And
like we said, at the beginning of the show, and we've said it a couple times. I mean, this is home mead making. Learning to make good mead at home. This is where it all starts. And this industry is still in its infancy, and it's still growing, and it's still in the experimental stage. I mean, we haven't even gotten out of the basement yet. I mean, people are trying all different kinds of things, and even putting them to work for them in the form of meaderies now, and the ability to be able to sell to the public. But, I mean, it's still very experimental, and I think that's the fun thing about doing mead. I mean, I do a few grape wines, but I could have concentrated more on that. But that's just simply putting grape juice in a bucket, pouring the yeast in, putting the lid on, and standing back and waiting. Mead, on the other hand, is being able to experiment with different flavors, different spices, different herbs, different fruits, different vegetables, and the fermentation process. I mean, this is something new that I've learned here tonight. I don't know about Aaron and Jeff, but I'm willing to, I'm not much of an experimenter when it comes to that kind of experiments, but I'm willing to get in line with Jeff and Aaron here. They, these two guys, you two have been experimenting for quite some time, so it sounds like something I need to get involved in.
And one of the top three meat makers in the world.
Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, Jeff Schaus, right here on the Mead House, live every Tuesday night. One of the top three meat makers in the world.
You guys are going to never let me live that down, of course.
No, sir. No, sir. No, sir.
There's no need to split hairs.
Yeah. So oxidative and reductive fermentation. Well, I mean, it's good science. It's good. It's a good thing to know. And I suppose if you're going to make good mead at home, it has to be more than just tossing honey and water in a bucket with a little bit of yeast and, like I said, standing back and waiting.
And the art, it comes down, like I said, the process of making really, really good mead, aerating, degassing, controlling temperature, feeding the yeast, covering the bucket either with a lid or with a cloth. These everything involved in making really, really good mead is the most simple thing in the world. Like I said, you can train a monkey to do it. It's not complicated. The difference between an okay mead maker and a world-class mead maker is simply knowing when to do it, when to do what. The stuff you do is not that complicated, but knowing when to do it and how to do it, that's the difference. I used to, a long time ago, I was a cabinet maker, and I made some custom furniture. And my furniture always turned out perfect. I had no waste. I had some friends who did woodwork, and they ran into all kind of problems. The stain didn't come out the right color, or a joint didn't hold together, or they had to recut pieces. And the reason was that I had done it for so long, I could look at a piece of wood, and I knew how it was going to stain out. I knew what color it was going to be. I could see a joint before I cut it, and I could see potential problems with a glue line or something. And I was able to see it before I did it, and they weren't. And it's, it's that way with everything you do, no matter what your hobby is, whether it's meat making or whatever, being able to envision the finished product before you start, will help you along the way. It'll help you make better mead or do better whatever you're doing. And that kind of stuff It just comes with practice. It comes with doing it. It comes with making bad batches and tossing them down the sink. But let me tie this in with this curry mead while we're on this discussion.
Yeah.
This little soapbox that I'm on here. A failure is never really a total failure. This curry mead,
unless it happens to be one of JD's meads.
Well, hear me out here. I'm saying this specifically because Dan had emailed about this curry. Yeah. This is not the kind of mead that you're going to sit and drink glass after glass. I can't see myself coming in and saying, hey, I'd like to have a glass of that curry mead. It's a novelty. And if nothing else, it's more of an exercise in learning how to layer flavors. It's fun. You know, can I take a recipe for a favorite food dish and turn it into a mead? How many different flavors can I cram into this thing and still be able to distinguish those flavors? And so, you know, some people may taste it and go, wow, this is incredible that you did this. And some people may go, God, this is awful. What were you thinking? it's not about, you know, this is not the mead you're going to make that's going to make you famous with all your friends or anything like that. This is an exercise in layering flavor. But let's just say you make this mead, Dan, or anybody listening, and it turns out to be something that you just don't like at all. That's not a complete failure, because I want you to look at the list of ingredients that's in that mead. You've got mango, cardamom, coriander, hot chili peppers. You've got almonds and peanuts. You've got toasted coconut. You've got this long list of ingredients. So if you don't like this mead when you get finished with it, pour a glass and sit down, get you a notebook and a pen, and try to zero in on one particular thing at a time. Ignore all the bad flavors, but ask yourself, how's the mango coming through? Is there plenty of mango here? And if the answer is yes, then you automatically know this is a good amount of mango to use in the future. So if in the future you want to make a mango mead, you know how much to use.
Yeah.
If there's not enough coming through, then you can say, well, this wasn't enough. I need more. Same thing with the coconut. Same thing with every ingredient there. Zero in on it and make notes and look at how much you added. And save that for future reference. Somewhere down the road, you may decide to make a mango coconut mead. And if the mango and coconut were coming through good in this one, even though you didn't like this particular mead, at least you know how much coconut and mango to use in that next mead you make. So you can always learn something, even from total failures.
Yeah.
So that's my soapbox on that.
What's that, Jim? Excuse me?
I said the only real failure here is a failure to learn.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've got all sorts of opportunities to make notes and use in the future when you get ready to do something. And so that's my soapbox on failed meads.
It was kind of funny when Chris got a hold of me this morning. We were texting each other, making some changes to that curry recipe that we had posted on our themeadhouse.com, folks. And one of the last texts he sends, he says, it pairs well with salads. And I looked at that and I thought, what the hell are you talking about? Pairs well with salads. So,
I made this mead, and when I got it finished, it wasn't what I was hoping for, so I made some changes. And this is actually the second go at this. And I have it right now in secondary.
Yeah.
So it's not even finished. And normally I don't like to put a recipe out unless I know that it's you know, it's ready to go. But this one is still a work in progress, but Dan asked for it, so there it is. And if we fail, we'll fail together if you make it, Dan. So.
Well, you know, and Dan might even be able to come up with an alternative to an ingredient that makes it taste, you know, even better, or an additional ingredient. Or I mean, and again, this is the fun thing, I think, about making mead. I know Jeff has that hibiscus thing, and thank you very much, Jeff. I got the package. I had sent some money to Jeff, and I asked him to pick me up his the same ingredients that he used in his hibiscus. And what was the other two?
There's chamomile. Hibiscus, there's chamomile, and then there's a little bit of sumac.
Yeah, right. And so I've got those. I'm gonna put a short one together when I get back from my trip, and really looking forward to working with Jeff on that, and picking up a few pointers from him. So, I mean, not that I would, you know, and I have been known to drop a rosemary sprig into a bottle of Chardonnay and recork it for a couple of days too, which I like very much. But, you know, I've never given much thought to making mead out of flower petals. You know, so this will be a new one for me.
Well, and really the credit to this belongs to my wife, because if she was the one that said, hey, you should try a hibiscus mead one day when we were wandering through the farmer's market and we happened upon the Spice Guy's stand.
Yeah. Well,
and it's one of the top three meads in the world.
It is. It you know, I mean, you know, I like flowers too. I mean, I take pictures of flowers, lots of pictures of flowers. And if you've ever seen a hibiscus plant and smell the flower, they smell rather pleasant. So why shouldn't you know, a mead made with hibiscus petals not taste good? So, you know, I'm game.
Well, and there is a level of parity to making a mead with flowers, just because the honey comes from flowers too.
Yeah. Well, there you go. And I've got
speaking of that, you had some feedback. Were we gonna ask him about that?
Oh yeah, big time. Jeff, the third world's best mead maker in the world. What was the feedback?
Well, and this was part of my consternation, is that I really didn't get a lot of feedback. The third best mead in the world made it through two rounds. The first round, I got no feedback whatsoever, other than just the scores and the little ticks as to what flavors they detected. There was no like actual comments written down on the sheet. And the second round, there was a little bit more. There was some comment of, you know, some age would improve this. This is a young mead, and that's fair. It's a little less than a year old, so it's still, you know, it's still aging up to where it ought to be. But yeah, that was really all the commentary I got on that, and that was a little bit, you know, frustrated when I opened up my score sheets, because to me, it's all well and good, you know, winning medals and little cups and everything, but the reason I started getting into competing in these was not to win medals or to, you know, to win awards and stuff. It was really to get feedback from people that are, you know, more knowledgeable in this area than I am, because, you know, pretty much since I started brewing, my main feedback other than my own palate has been, you know, friends and family. And, you know, really, I don't think I don't think I've ever brewed a bad mead.
Yeah, and
fantastic.
They're not going to lie to you and tell you your mead tastes like crap either, are they? But yeah, I've been there, done that too. I mean, you know, you hand off a bottle of what you think is, you know, pretty good stuff to your relatives, and oh yeah, that's pretty good stuff, JD. You know, well, you want another bottle? No, you know. But yeah, I would have expected. I mean, and this is something. Now, I only say this because of my time that I had put in on that other radio show and dealing with some folks that are directly involved with judging in the major cup and the whole nine yards. that was kind of the big thing. They always talked about that, about being able to get feedback. You know, so what, you're not interested in the medal. You know, the important thing is getting the feedback from the judge so that you know where you're going with this. You know what improvements you need to make, or what changes you need to make. And that would have been something that absolutely I would have been looking forward to.
Yeah, no, that, I think, and that's not to say I didn't enjoy winning the medal, or, and my little Mazur cup isn't sitting on a little high shelf in my kitchen where I'm all proud of it. But yeah, no, the commentary is really what I was looking forward to. And I just, you know, we had four entries and they all got pretty sparse feedback.
Does it discourage you from, now you said you had entered another competition as well, right?
Well, I've entered a few. And I think there are pros and cons to every competition. I think the example I sent from you guys was from Meadlenium. It was in Silver Springs, Florida, if memory serves. And they were using the BJCP standard score sheet instead of the Mazur Cup score sheet.
Are you talking about the one down in Georgia?
No, it's in a suburb of Orlando.
Okay.
But yeah, you can find the BJCP score sheet online. It's at bjcp.org. You can just Google search BJCP Mead score sheet and it'll pull it up. I really like it because on the far left hand side, there's a list of like the potential faults for the judges to look for. So they have like that kind of a reminder ready for them. Yeah. And then there's big chunks of spaces where you can write a paragraph about each of the different factors that go into the score, like the appearance, the clarity, the feel, the presentation. And then you get a little extra space at the bottom for kind of all the little what's the term they use? All those little factors that you
can put a finger.
Thank you. That's exactly the word they use for it.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I really like that, and I kind of look back at, you know, the Mazur Cup score sheets I got this year, and even the Mazur Cup score sheets I got last year when it was actually the first competition I'd ever entered, and then I looked at like some of the other score sheets we've gotten from, you know, the competitions that use the standardized score sheets, and went, wow, I'm getting so much more feedback from these smaller competitions.
And I wonder if that's not just a function of the fact that you've got a limited number of judges and you're overwhelmed with so many needs to judge. Maybe that could be part of it also.
I think that's precisely it. I mean, the Mazur Cup capped their entries at 450 this year, which is a lot of meads to get through in a single afternoon.
Sure, dude. If your mead comes in 103rd, I probably wouldn't expect a whole lot on the score sheet. But if I place third, you know, what was it that kept me from being first? I would want to know. You know, I mean, if I scored that high, maybe the same could be said for the other way around too, I guess. But
I suppose so. Yeah, if you're placing further, you know, 103rd, further towards the rear, maybe there just are more faults and more pieces of feedback, constructive criticism to provide to make it better at that point.
Yeah.
But see, I'm a very vain person, so I'm in it for the medal. I don't really care. I've got plenty of alcoholic friends who let me know what's good and what's not. When they call back and want me to make another 5-gallon batch and they say, oh, could you make a 15-gallon batch? I know that's a pretty good mead, so I don't have to worry. I just want the medal.
It's not that it's a pretty good mead. It's just all your friends want to get drunk again. That's all.
Probably so. Yeah. Either way, they're drinking what I'm making, so I'm not worried.
There you go. Well, go ahead.
Well, I think to answer your previous question about kind of my takeaway from this. I'm thinking really the end result is going to be maybe I'm not going to send a whole four entries that I think are kind of the best stuff that I did this year to the Mazer Cup. Maybe I'm going to spread those around to smaller competitions. I don't think I will stop entering at all, but realistically, they have a lot of meets to judge in a very short period of time. So I think really I'm going to send what I think are, the good contenders to win medals and, not really go as much for the commentary in future competitions.
Yeah.
Yeah, collect those medals. You know, if you need honest feedback, I know JD and Aaron both have mail, and we here in Mississippi, we recently started getting mail delivery here. So you can send us mead, and when we'll give you an honest feedback.
Yeah.
Well, it is funny you mentioned that. My wife has pretty much demanded that I, now that the hibiscus has won like third in category, that I scale it up from a 1 gallon batch to a 5 gallon batch. So I have a feeling I'll have a little bit more on hand to send you guys here shortly. And you can try for yourselves.
What honey did you use with that again?
I just used a regular wildflower honey from around these parts. I didn't want to go anything too strong because really the chamomile flavor is kind of delicate. And then it's surprising that it doesn't get lost behind the hibiscus and they really like complement each other. But I didn't want that to overwhelm the floral characteristics, especially the nose, because you put your nose up to this and get a really good whiff of it and you get a full floral effect of it.
What's your wife's name?
Sheila.
Sheila, well, When I get my mead, my hibiscus mead done, I'm going to send a bottle to Judge Sheila and get her input, because it's going to be made with wildflower honey, but of the El Monte variety, which is my local supplier. So Judge Sheila, if you're listening, I'm looking forward to sending you a bottle. My personal mead judge. Hibiscus mead judge.
Yeah, you might get lucky and be fourth best.
I've got a traditional sitting here that I was supposed to send into the Mazer Cup, but it's not near ready. It might be ready for next year's. I'm not looking for any medals. I'm kind of like Jeff. I'm just looking for feedback. And so now, and I don't want to be discouraged by Jeff's, discouragement of not getting feedback, because that's specifically what I'm looking for. So I'm kind of looking forward to sending a bottle in and, seeing, because my mentor, the person that mentored me through this process is Peter Bocklich. He's like,
he's the president of the Mazer Cup.
Yeah, he's the president of the Mazer Cup, and he's a renowned, well-versed. I mean, his family's been making wines for centuries, so he's very well-versed in this whole mead-making process, and he's the one that mentored me through this traditional. So, send it in and see what we get back. That's all I'm looking for how did I do? What do I need to improve?
Well, and really, I really don't want this to be a knock the Mazer Cup because I didn't get feedback episode.
No, not at all. But,
there is the level which, you have to put this into perspective. And I think if anything, really the takeaway here is for everybody listening, look around for your local brew clubs, because there are, in the Kansas City metro area where I hail from, there are at least three of them that I'm aware of. And they all have their own like regional competitions where, you may have, especially if they're mainly a brew club, you may have a very small number of meads to compete against, and those judges are going to have all afternoon to give you commentary and feedback.
Well,
yeah, and Jeff, I would also add this. entering as many competitions as you can is not a bad idea either, because you know just as well as I do that we all have things that we are able to detect better than other people, and judges are no different. There's going to be judges who can pick up on certain flaws that other judges can't. And it's all in our sensory ability. You know, I know judges who, if you give them a mead that's been sweetened, been back sweetened, they wouldn't know the difference. But I know other people who can almost tell the difference in before they even taste it. They can tell the difference in a back sweetened mead just in the aroma. They can smell the raw honey. So you're going to find judges all over the country that are going to have, you know, the ability to detect things that other judges may not be able to. So if you really want to get good, true feedback, enter that same meet in as many competitions as you can.
No, you're absolutely right there. I actually took a little sensory class, I want to say about a year and a half ago. There's a microbrewery in town called Boulevard Beer that's becoming bigger and bigger, and they're really getting a lot of success, which is fantastic because they totally deserve it. They make fantastic beers. And the woman that set up their quality assurance board, they're, you know, where they're tasting each batch and kind of making sure there's no contaminations or off flavors or things, and it's consistent, was talking about how there are some really, really obscure, like bad flavors that only a very small percentage of the population like actually picks up. Like she tested something like 70 employees before she found one that could pick up that one flavor. So yeah, it's there are definitely a wide range of abilities to pick up different flavors, and you know,
are you holding your phone, Jeff?
Yeah, I'm holding my phone.
Oh, that's why it's making some noise. Like you're putting it in and out of your pocket or something.
Oh, I'm also outside tonight.
Oh, cool.
It's a little less noisy out here than it is in the house.
Oh, I love being on the back porch.
With a big glass of mead.
Yeah. Or a protein shake.
Or a protein shake, yeah. Yeah. Well, I look forward to sending my meads in only for the feedback, and you know, I wish, because I'm looking forward to making this hibiscus, I was also kind of looking forward to, you know, Jeff sharing whatever kind of feedback he got from his, you know, to see if there was any changes coming down the pike, you know, whether Jeff was going to recommend, you know, adding this or taking some of this out or whatever. That was the one thing that I was kind of looking forward to, you know, with Jeff's, you know, when he said he's going to get the results back. So go ahead, Chris.
Oh, no, I was just, I may be jumping ahead here. I was just going to mention the experiments that Aaron and Jeff both, they both got two different experiments going. And I believe, Jeff, you had one with varietals, and was it varietals? Oh, no, you had the nutrient.
Yeah.
And then Aaron, you've got one going as well.
Yeah.
Correct.
You know,
yeah.
Before we get to that, Aaron, we're on day 14, real quickly, of this sweet mead that we put together on the first show, or the second show, rather. Day 14, where are we? We've already probably passed the racking point. We should have racked by now, or are we still in the primary?
So I think at this point we are still in the primary. If I recall correctly from the recipe, I think we won't rack to secondary here for another week, coming up at the 21-day mark. At this point also, have we added the vanilla bean yet, or is that yet to come?
That comes in secondary. Yeah,
that comes in secondary. So
right now we're just waiting.
Yeah, just waiting. So, again, it's a 5-gallon batch, 20 pounds of orange blossom honey. We use 71 BUs. We had a good regimen of, now you have your choice, because we did put the alternate methods up of your, of the yeast nutrient, feedings. And, so, those of you that might be, working on this recipe, you know, give us some feedback. If you haven't started the recipe, start it anyway. We got the recipe listed on the website, themeathouse.com. Throw it together. Track it well. Let us know how you're doing with it. We'd love to hear from you. So,
And just as another point, just to tie in with our discussion tonight, that sweet mead is a hybrid oxidative reductive ferment as well. So,
yeah, because we left the towel on it for the first 7 days, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And then we airlocked it. So, yeah. You're going to get the benefits of both.
And so Aaron's got this varietal experiment going. Let's talk to Aaron first, and we'll talk to Jeff. Because I'm interested in Jeff's nutrient deal, too. Aaron, what's the latest on your blueberry, cranberry, raspberry? What was the other one?
The last one is a sunflower blossom.
Sunflower blossom.
Yeah. So I think it's been a couple few weeks since I gave an update on this. At this point, all four batches are still aging in secondary and just waiting for them to clarify a little bit before bottling. I think the first time that we talked about this, I gave a little bit of an overview on the different flavor characteristics I was getting from these four different honey varietals after about a month or so in primary. And just to kind of recap a little bit about the recipe, each of these batches was taken up to an initial gravity of 25 bricks. And, you know, we were talking about some of the failures, and the only failure is the failure not to learn. And I just love that. I had initially pitched some Cefal, I think, what is it, the US05 ale yeast. And after about 48 hours, there was just a failure to launch. So at that point, I pitched some D47, and it just took off like a rocket. This was also my first experience using Sergio Mutella's tailored organic staggered nutrient addition, or the TASNA method, using the Fermade O organic nitrogen for the nutrient additions. So, you know, I think the last time with some of the updates that I had given, the cranberry had a real interesting tartness with kind of a malty aftertaste to it. It also was just kind of a brilliant red color. And all in all, I would say that is the batch that most closely resembled the fruit of the blossom from which the honey source came from. The sunflower one was my favorite of the four batches and had a very nice crisp tartness, almost like a Granny Smith apple type of a flavor, and the aroma just smelled like apple juice. So I'm real excited to see how that one progresses. But on the last two, the blueberry and the raspberry. So the blueberry one was really interesting to me. It kind of has like a buttery, almost waxy aroma to it, and the flavor is almost a little spicy, maybe a little peppery, or at one point I think Chris used the term minty. So definitely getting some flavors there, kind of along the spicy profile.
Well, that buttery, waxy aroma, I mean, is that a pleasant smell? Is that a pleasant aroma? Or, I mean, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's just kind of bland. I have to say the blueberry one probably just doesn't have, both from an aroma and a flavor standpoint, it's also probably one of the more subdued batches as well. So it's not off-putting, it's not like knock your socks off delicious smelling either. It's just kind of bland.
Okay. And which one do you say that was? It's kind of bland.
That was the blueberry.
The blueberry. Okay.
Yep. So then just lastly, the last batch here was the raspberry one. Also a little more on the delicate side on the aroma, although it had a little more of a floral smell to it. And it's interesting, the raspberry had a very similar initial flavor as the cranberry. It kind of has a real nice tartness to it, almost like that Granny Smith apple. But whereas the cranberry finishes with more of like a malty aftertaste, the raspberry finishes with just a real clean, crisp finish, and doesn't really have that heavier malty flavor, you know, on the back end there. I will also say that the raspberry of the four batches had the most like hot fusel alcohol type flavor to it as well. But just in general, all four of these were just so less hot tasting with the Tasna method than any of my previous batches. So that's kind of where we wound up with them. And I'll tell you, one of the things I'm interested in, it's fascinating to me how the same procedure and the same nutrient additions and everything, you know, can be the same, but just changing the honey varietal can have such a profound impact or change on the finished product. And I was kind of reading about some of these honey varietals in Ken Schramm's book, The Complete Mead Maker. And it's interesting to me looking at some of the different like honey component or sugar components that make these up. So reading through there, it looks like there's four major types of sugars that comprise honey. You've got levulose, dextrose, sucrose, and maltose. And some observations about these. The cranberry of the four has the, you know, relatively high levels of sucrose. It's almost double that of the raspberry. So I'm not sure if maybe that's what produces kind of that malty flavor potentially. The blueberry has higher levels of dextrose, maltose, and levulose. So I'm just wondering if maybe that's what gives it kind of that peppery flavor. And then lastly, I noticed that the raspberry has kind of medium to low levels of all four of the sugars. So maybe that's what gives it kind of that real clean finish type of a thing. So definitely was interesting to me to kind of take a look at some of that data as it relates to the experiment.
Yeah.
How would you, Aaron? How would you rate the mouthfeel and the body of those four? Because I've always heard that the raspberry honey was more of a heavy-bodied honey.
You know, it's interesting. The raspberry probably was on the lighter side. Now, this particular raspberry honey was very, very runny compared to the other honeys. Like the other ones were much thicker and more viscous, and this particular raspberry honey was just very watery. So I don't know if that might play a role here as well. The cranberry definitely had the heaviest body and the thickest mouthfeel of the four varietals.
These were all from the same vendor?
They are, yep, all from the same vendor. The raspberry was actually a new varietal that they just started carrying as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited to see how they progress. You know, I think for the last several weeks, they've just been under airlock there in the secondary. So definitely looking forward to the point where they clarify and I can get them in the bottle and try some new samples at that point.
So at this point, which would you say, can you rate them 1 to 4 as your best to worst or favorites or whatever?
Absolutely. So the sunflower one was far and away my favorite. Follow that up with the cranberry, just the interesting balance there of like the tartness that you get in the initial flavor, and then that malty after flavor that you get, it's just kind of complex and quite different. So cranberry would be number two. The raspberry would be number three. Just I like that nice clean finish that you get there. And then the blueberry, just with kind of that bland flavor I was describing, although it does have kind of the peppery or minty flavor to it, that would be number four for me.
That's interesting.
I'm taking notes here.
You know, and I'll tell you one other thought. This is something that Jeff mentioned with regards to his experiment too, is, you know, take this for what it's worth at this point. These are samples that I took after a month of primary fermentation, and certainly after, you know, another couple of months here, maybe in secondary, and then once we get them into bottles, who knows what they'll taste like, you know, 2 months from now, 6 months from now, if they last that long. So,
they can swap places. Your least favorite now could turn out to be your best.
Exactly. Exactly.
JD and I, we're about to have a little varietal test going with the difference between California and Florida orange blossom.
Interesting.
I've heard so many people talk about, you know, these differences, and so I have Florida orange blossom where I live. That's where all of ours come from. And JD, he sent me some California, and I'm going to send him some Florida, and we're going to sort of do a side by side comparison. Even though I personally don't expect a drastic difference, but I can tell you, tasting what JD sent, the California is definitely a heavier bodied honey, and it's got a much higher level of sugar than the Florida does. So that's what the two main things that, and I guess I would say that the California maybe is a little bit more mellow. If you ever had take a spoonful of honey and you swallow it and you get that little burn in the back of your throat, mm-hmm. the California orange blossom has none of that. It's completely void of that little burn, whereas the Florida has quite a bit of it. So that's going to be an interesting. I think we're going to have to really start getting down into the nitty gritty details to be able to detect any differences, and it may be beyond my ability to do. So we may have to send you guys some samples of that and let you get your opinion on it.
Oh darn! I may have to drink mead for the show.
You know, somebody's got to do the dirty work.
Twist my arm.
Always a party at the mead house.
Hey, there you go. You know, the thing about the raspberry, you know, raspberries is one fruit. And I remember, going through my grandmother's garden and picking raspberries and popping them in your mouth. It wasn't like picking strawberries. Strawberries had a much sweeter taste to them. The raspberries were these little tart little bombs, little tart bombs that you had. But I wonder if that has anything to do with it too. I mean, the fruit in general is rather tart to start with, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, and another thing I'm excited to do as well. I just so happened to save just a small amount of each of these honeys as well. So, you know, when I get to that point where these are in bottles and they've, you know, gone through at least a few months of aging, I'll plan on doing kind of a side-by-side comparison of the honey and then the mead, just to kind of really try to pick out how the flavors in the honey, once you strip away that sweetness, how that kind of translates to the finished product. And hoping to kind of learn a little bit, you know, what.
Yeah. You said that last week, and I was really paying attention there, because that's a very interesting concept that I'm going to start doing. Is saving back a little, just a little dab of honey, a little Tupperware thing, put it away, label it, you know, this honey went in this mead on this date. And it'd be interesting comparison to see, you know, how it turns out. I like that idea.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to do that. And what I'm hoping is that in doing so, I'll get to the point where, you know, you can kind of taste a honey and know what that's going to translate to in the fermented beverage, you know, in the finished product.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the big benefit is learning how to strip away that sweetness and identify what's going to come from that honey when it's all fermented down. You know, I've done that same thing before, and it does. It really helps. Although I got to say, I still am sound horrible when it comes to trying to see into the future of what it's going to taste like. And you know, that's what I was saying earlier about these making a great mead maker is being able to see what it's going to be before you start. And I would say that that's where I've got a long way to go. I need more practice there than anywhere, is just being able to envision what it's going to turn into.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Jeff's got, you know, and one of the things that will really impact the outcome of your mead too is, you know, the nutrients that you put in during the fermentation process. Jeff's got a pretty good experiment going on using different, what is it, Jeff, different varieties of nutrients plus a mixture of different varieties, right?
Right. Yeah, there are three different nutrients at question here, and two of them kind of go together. There's diammonium phosphate, or DAP, as it's commonly known, and Fermaid K. Then there's Fermaid O, which is essentially very similar, but it's made from autolyzed yeast cells instead of essentially chemically derived nitrogen. So it's organic in the sense of it comes from a living thing in terms of its source rather than a chemical reaction. But anyway, the experiment compares a few different schedules for these nutrient additions against my previous way of doing it, which was essentially just exactly what the label said, everything at pitch and by, you know, quarters of a tablespoon. So we are 4 weeks into that experiment, and not this last weekend, but the weekend before, we went from primary to secondary. So I took the opportunity to do a first taste test there too. My wife got in on this as well. And the thing that really amazed me is that there are major differences between these batches. And to recap here, the batches are all derived from the same 5 gallon batch. It's the same quantity of honey. I pitched the yeast into it, and then after the pitch and everything was well mixed, I divided it into 5 separate gallon containers. So
this was prior to fermenting, right? This is prior to it starting to ferment.
Yeah, I pitched it, I gave it a really good mix, and then I divided it. Yeah. So everything started fermenting on its own around about the same time, but they were independently, they were in independent containers by the time fermentation actually picked up.
Yeah, okay.
So anyway, the thing that really struck me here is that there are noticeably different flavors coming off of these meads based on these schedules. And it's actually really striking the differences you're seeing between them. I mean, the other thing that was really interesting to me was that what I would have expected to be, you know, the out the gate winner, according to my taste, ranked second, and according to my wife's taste, ranked fourth.
Wow.
What I expected to be kind of what based on my understanding of the difference between Fermaid O and Fermaid K in terms of its bioavailability to yeast, seemed like it would be a dud is actually, to both of us, the winner here, at least for the moment. And of course, this comes with the same caveat that Aaron mentioned, where we're only 4 weeks into this experiment. Things could change, and things could change drastically because we're barely into secondary. So there's still a lot of maturing and a lot of time that comes into this, but it did strike me as really interesting that there are such huge flavor differences. I mean, the one that I expected to be the winner, bar none, like I said, it came in really well. The other one that I expected to do pretty well is actually one of what I would rate as the worst. It had kind of not even a bad flavor per se, but just almost like a watered down, very bland flavor where nothing was coming through.
Wow. Interesting.
You know what I would like to do? I'd like for you to wait until, say, let's set 3 months from your pitch date or 4 months or whatever you're comfortable with. And then you and your wife both could do complete tasting notes on each one. And then let's put on the website, let's list all five on the website with your exact nutrient schedule for each one and along with your tasting notes for each one. I think that's some really valuable information.
Yeah,
absolutely. And actually, what I was thinking about doing was recruiting a few friends to do essentially a blind taste test, where I wouldn't tell them anything about the differences between these meads or really how slight the differences are, and say, well, you know, here's what you should look for. Tell me what you see, and kind of go from there. I think that would be really an interesting way, because as much as I would love this to be a purely scientific study, it isn't. There's a level of objectivity that goes into the taste of a mead, and I think that'd be a really great, really interesting way to get some different feedback.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think you should probably set a time, like, say, 3 or 4 months from pitch day, because that it gives it enough time to clear. And it gives it enough time for things to sort of come together. But if you wait too long, you know, a lot of these flaws that come from the nutrients not being quite on time, those kinds of things normally will age out. So it's very possible that in a year from now, they could all five be totally equal.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you know where I'm going with this, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I had kind of anticipated a 3 month time frame for doing that when I was getting this together, because no, you're right. These differences could all age out relatively quickly. And to be completely honest, with about one third of my batches of mead kind of like stalling or slowing down pretty severely into secondary so far, I kind of expected my control to do that too. So there was there's part of me that's not feeling like all five of them are going to be clear when it comes time to do this test. I think I may be serving at least one cloudy mead here.
Well, that's just got to go in. You know, you got to take that in consideration as part of the result.
Mm-hmm.
So who's to say that it wasn't the nutrient schedule that caused it, you know?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Especially since it all came out of the, you know, everything else was exactly the same. So something had to cause it. And if the only variable is the nutrients, then we got to just look at the facts and the results.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, I don't, at this point, I don't think it really has to be a scientific. I mean, I think you're doing everything right, and I think the blind taste test is a huge thing. You know, when you have unknown people tasting something that, you know, they don't know what's in it, that's going to provide some pretty good feedback, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
We have a listener. I just want to throw a shout out. One of our listeners is in Oregon, somewhere in Oregon, and he's listening, he or she listening on an Apple iPhone. We just want to throw a shout out and say, howdy, thanks for joining us here tonight. See, we can watch you. We know who's listening from where. So that's a pretty cool deal here at the Mead.
JD is a big brother of Mead.
I'm the big brother of Mead.
You may be listening to us, but we're watching you.
We're watching you. As we close the show out here tonight, I get asked all the time about my Rube Goldberg systems that I put together, and I know Chris and I talked about this here a few weeks back about this cooling system. I did manage to put, I had it up last week as part of the show notes. Remember that show from hell? Remember that show from hell we had?
Which one was that?
Yeah,
I don't remember that.
That was the last one, but. I did put up the some information about my cooling system, which is quite efficient. I thought I'd spend just the last few minutes here kind of describing that for anybody who's interested. It's rather simple. Price-wise, I mean, it's going to be less than $100, probably less than $75 even. If you get really industrious, it might even be less than $50. It just depends on where you buy all of your equipment. The one thing I gotta tell you that I failed to put in the post though is when you go buy the copper tubing, make damn sure it is plumbing grade, for water pipe copper, because apparently there is a difference out there and you want to be safe. Although the copper will never touch your Mead, it's always to err on the safe side of things. So
what you want to look for is called K copper, the letter K.
Yeah,
that designates potable water grade copper.
Yeah, and I think I saw that on the package that my tubing came in. But simply, it's about 40 feet. Now you can go more than 40 feet, but I find that 40 feet is adequate for a 5-gallon carboy and a 3-gallon carboy. And you simply wind your copper around the carboy. And once you get that wound around, then you have a 48-gallon or you know what, you could probably get away with a smaller size cooler too. And this is dependent upon how many carboys you want to cool. If you've only got one carboy, I would recommend something smaller than a 48-quart cooler. And inside that cooler is a submersible pond pump. And you can get those at the hardware store. I think I listed everything at Amazon.com. And they're, $15-$20. You want something that's around 150 to 180 gallons per hour. That's really all you need. You just need to move the water through, and what it's doing is circulating through that copper. It's actually drawing the heat out of the carboy. Some plastic tubing, some vinyl tubing to go, obviously, from your cooler. And I just simply drilled holes on the back of the cooler, fed the tubing through to the pump, and ran that up to the copper tubing, hose clamped it together. Get stainless steel hose clamps if you can find them. But again, none of this is going to come in contact with the Mead, but I always try to do everything safely. And you get the digital controller from Amazon. It's called an STC-1000, and it's what they call a double relay. It actually controls heat and cold. Now, you can get away with the single if all you want to do is cool, but I have the other side also hooked up to a fermenter where I can actually warm up my fermenter and I can cool it down at the same time if I have to.
And those controllers are only like $15 or so, right?
Yeah, they're like $15, $17, less than $20 on Amazon. a lot less than the $75, even $150 controllers that do the same thing, the exact same thing that I've seen at some of these brew shops, you know, that are commonly used. The wiring, there's one of the best instructional videos of this guy that puts the, it's about 40 minutes long, but you want to watch the entire thing because he really goes into quite a bit of detail about putting the project box together, about wiring this digital controller up, and you're wiring it up to a regular household outlet that you install in a project box, and that allows you to plug your submersible pump into that, and that's how the digital controller starts and stops the pump when required. The probe into the you'll need to get a bung that has two holes. You can get the the word just went right out of my freaking mind. What's it called, guys?
Thermocouple.
Thermal well. The bung that has a thermal well, and you want to get it long enough so that it goes quite a ways down into your carboy, and then you run the thermal couple, the probe part of the STC-1000, down inside the thermal well, and that's what feeds the information back to the controller, starts and stops your pump when required according to the temperature that you set it at. Now, I've had mine all the way down to 55 degrees Fahrenheit on a pretty consistent basis. And I don't recommend using, ice cubes, bags of ice, that kind of thing, because that is really very inefficient. What you want to do, what I use for a 48-quart cooler is two 2.5-gallon Tupperware containers that I put in the freezer, in my stand-up freezer. It takes a couple of days for that to freeze, but I'm looking at roughly a 40-hour time period before I have to change ice, and that's with the pump continuously plugged in. It's not on all the time because obviously once it gets to temperature, the pump stops and starts. And also, it also depends upon the ambient temperature where the cooler is sitting. So if your house is at, say, 75 degrees, it's probably not going to be as efficient as I am at roughly 68 degrees. So you want to keep that in mind. Now, the other thing that you can do to increase your efficiency, something that I'm looking at, is actually going to the Yeti coolers, which are quite expensive. Now you're looking at coolers that are, you know, several hundred dollars for, you know, just a small one. But they're extremely efficient. You'll find a lot of the fishermen up in Alaska use the Yeti brand coolers because they're so extremely efficient. But all of the plans, all of the information is on the website, themeathouse.com. It's very easy to put together, and it works. It works well. Like I say, I'm able to keep two carboys and my fermenter, my stainless steel fermenter that has a submersible immersion chiller. I can keep those running for almost 40 hours without having to change the ice. And I'm constantly working on the efficiency part of it too. So, but
and your accuracy at temperature control is probably down to a couple of degrees either way, right?
Oh yeah, plus minus a couple of degrees, maybe even 1 degree that I've been able to detect. So, as far as getting it down past 55, you can't cold crash. You know, this is something that it won't do because in order to cold crash, you got to get down into the at least the mid 30s. 34, 35 degrees, 36 degrees in order to cold crash. Of course, that's based on everything that I've read. It won't go that far, but for keeping a carboy cool during fermentation, if you have an immersion chiller, it works brilliantly. For keeping a carboy cool during secondary, you want to keep it sub 65 degrees, which is a very good aging temperature. It'll do that. And yeah, you know, it's a very easy project to put together. So, you know,
well, for all you people who've been hearing me harp about the importance of temperature control, you now have no excuse. For $100 or less, you can put together something that you can control plus or minus 1 or 2 degrees. And, you know, that's like $25 a week.
Yeah.
So, you know, we could be like one of those commercials on TV. You know, for $25 a week, you could help millions and millions of struggling yeast reach their potential.
There you go.
And for all you're absolutely right. I mean, this is not something that's going to break the bank. I mean, the JD mentioned using the STC 1000 controller. Funnily enough, that it's actually a very versatile controller. I'm actually looking at using that for my own my refrigerator to fermentation chamber conversion here too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, and we might throw out also, I had suggested sort of a variation on JD's design where you take a container that's bigger than your fermentation bucket and you actually wind the copper tubing through that and fill that up with water so that your fermentation bucket is sitting in water. And because water has such a good coefficient of energy, when you get the water on the outside of your fermentation bucket to a certain temperature, you can rest assured your mead is also going to be at that same temperature because it has water has a very efficient heat transfer. So, if you're keeping the water surrounding the bucket at 62 degrees, your mead's going to be 62 degrees. So that's another way, and we haven't tested that yet, but I have a feeling that that may possibly even increase the efficiency even more, especially if you have a way to insulate that outer container.
Yeah, that's you know, one of the things I didn't put, and I'll make an addendum to the post. And I didn't put it in there on purpose because I'm still kind of experimenting, but I do have a bubble wrap insulation that goes around, it wraps around the outside of the carboy and the copper, and it pretty much seals it in. And I can't tell yet whether it has increased the efficiency yet or not. If it does, it's unnoticeable. But I'm still playing around with the thickness of the insulation. So purposely I left that out because I just, you know, I can't sit here and tell you that, you know, yeah, you should, you know, wrap this insulation around it because I just don't know yet. So, but I like the idea that Chris is talking about the water thing. And when I get back from North Carolina, that's absolutely one of the things I'm going to do. That'll be a good test because it's all Rube Gold. I mean, you can go out and buy the same thing for hundreds of dollars and spend hundreds and hundreds of dollars on methods to cool and to, you know, develop a cooling system. Thousands of dollars even if you get involved in the, you know, the, not the Freon, what do they call it?
Glycol.
Coolers. I mean, they're like thousands of dollars.
Oh, $1,500 easy.
Yeah. So, you know.
But for the price of a cup of coffee for 75 cents a day,
you can help
a stressed out yeast reach its full potential. won't you try it today?
Won't you try today? Won't you try to help these struggling yeast? So, but yeah, it absolutely works. Yes, there's a little bit of work to it, and no, you're not going to get out from underneath that unless, like Jeff, you go to a, you know, a Chris I know has got a refrigeration system utilizing a small refrigerator. The STC-1000 will absolutely, all you're doing is replacing that submersible pump with the plug from the refrigerator. That's all you're doing.
Well, I'm going to build your Rube Goldberg cooler because the little refrigerator will only fit one container at a time. So, and it's basically just out of a dorm room. It's the same kind of refrigerator that dorm rooms use. And if you catch a dorm at a college near you at midterm or at the end of term, when they're cleaning out and they sell the old things and get new ones, and you can pick them up for $50 or $75. But I've only got one, so you know I need another way to. I might want to have two or three batches going, and this is a cheap way to do it.
It is, absolutely.
My finished project isn't going to be a lot better. It's the free refrigerator that I'm converting was a French door refrigerator, so I figure I will have space for a big 5 or 6 gallon bucket at the bottom, and maybe get a few of the 1 gallon batches above it. And then the other side is going to be all freezer. So unless I'm cold crashing something, it's probably not going to get used much.
Well, no, that's actually the freezer. If you can segregate out the power, if you can separate the freezing component from the refrigeration component, you can actually have it doing both. I've seen plans, YouTube videos where people have taken the same, you know, a refrigerator with a top part that's the freezer and the bottom part's the refrigerator. Mm-hmm. Gutted the whole interior out and have created a fermentation chamber utilizing the entire refrigerator. So it's possible.
And I've thought about doing that. The real issue as it stands, though, is whether the refrigeration part is separate from the freezer, or kind of in a crude way of putting it, just blowing some cold air from the freezer into the fridge to keep it cold.
Right.
And I haven't really like ripped it open to see because I've still got stuff aging in there.
Well, we're about 10, 12 minutes past our 0 hour, but I mean, as always, we always have fun talking about stuff here. Kind of wanted to go through what's in the hopper. Maybe we'll save that for next week. I don't know if we did that last week or not. I'm still recovering from the show, you know, the third show from hell.
I can't remember what we talked about last week. I think people might want to disregard that show because we probably made some stuff up as we went. So,
well, Eric Newquist was on. I really want to get him back on again. I did start my coffee mead. Chris, I know you've been working on getting one going as well. We'll talk about that on the next show. You know, I'm really eager to talk about it because I think mine's coming out really good, and we'll go in a little bit more detail. And I'm sure Jeff, you probably got things in the hopper, and Aaron, you know, keep track of that experiment you're doing. Want to hear more about that for sure. And we'll probably have a recipe or two next week. What do you think, guys?
Sounds good to me.
What we can do. Let's especially give a shout out to Eric Newquist. Thanks for joining us last week, and we definitely want to have you back on because you've got some good information on some things, especially something that I'm interested in is the cocoa nibs. I want to talk to you some more about that. So if you're listening, maybe we can get you on after we have our little 2 week break or so.
Yep. Yeah, and that's coming up here in the next few weeks. So, you know, check the schedule on the webpage, themeadhouse.com. That's where you can get all the information you need to know about the Mead House radio show. So,
But we will be here next week.
Yep, absolutely. We'll be here next week. So, with that. We'll see you next Tuesday night, 9 o'clock, right here on the Mead House Show. So join us.